Good evening, and thank you for coming. If you're a visitor at St. John Fisher, my name is Catherine Coolidge. I'm the Director of Evangelization here, and I'd like to, on behalf of my senior Sork and the staff and our parish, welcome you for coming. It's a great privilege and honor to introduce to you Amy Welburn, who's come to speak to us on Decoding Da Vinci. I know a lot of you, like a lot of us, find her weblog a good thing to touch base with and find out what's going on from time to time. And it's a great privilege and blessing to have her here this evening. So without further ado, I'll let her introduce herself, Amy Welburn.
Thank you, Catherine, and I have to thank Catherine very much for bringing me out here. We've been talking about this for a year or so. I'm looking back over my email, I discovered, and you know, you really have a treasure here. I've known Catherine for probably almost 5 years via the internet, but this is the first time I've met her, and she's one of the wisest people I know. So, you know, props to her. The Da Vinci Code. The movie is coming out in less than a month. May 19th is the release date. And one of the things that you're going to hear, and probably you've heard people say over and over and over again, is why get upset about a novel? It's only a novel. It's fiction. It's a movie. It's got Tom Hanks in it. You know, why do you care about what this says about Jesus and Mary Magdalene and the early church and all of that kind of thing? And I'm going to answer that question by telling you a little bit about how I got into this Da Vinci Code business. It's not my only business, thank goodness. It's something that I just kind of fell into a couple of years ago, actually 3 years ago. By way of background, I have a bachelor's in history, a master's in church history, and I have taught in Catholic high schools, and I was a DRE in the parish as well. And 3 years ago, our Sunday visitor called me, for which I was writing regularly at the time, and they said, the editor said, you know, there's this novel that's just come out, and it's got something to do with the Catholic Church, and I think Opus Dei is in it. Would you like to review it? Because that's one of the things I was doing at the time, was reviewing books. And I said, sure, send it along. So they sent the book along, and I read it, and I didn't think much of it, and this is not going to be an exercise in literary criticism, but there it is. And I wrote what was given to me, which was a 700-word space, review, in which I basically said I thought it was poorly written and the history within it is absurd. And I sort of mocked that history, you know, suggesting that Constantine was responsible for establishing the divinity of Christ and all of that kind of thing. And I thought that was it, because, you know, it's only a novel. But then, this was in, I guess, June 2003, the review got put on the internet. Our Sunday visitor put it on their website, of course. Opus Dei picked it up and stuck it on their website. And I started getting email. And it was the most interesting email. Basically two categories. The first category of email said things like, my sister, my coworker, my brother-in-law, my mom read this novel, and it disturbed them. They don't understand how the Catholic Church could have been responsible for these horrible things. They don't understand why the truth about Jesus and Mary Magdalene was hidden and covered up, or at the very least, they just don't understand. And they have questions, and I don't know how to answer the questions. Can you help me? And the second kind of letter I started getting was rooted in the same kind of understanding of the Da Vinci Code, but it was of a very different tone. I got letters from people who would write me and say, you are a typically brainwashed Catholic, parentheses, as if there were any other kind. Okay, that's a quote. As a woman, you should know better. As a woman, you should be ashamed. There will be, in the end, there will be a dark side and a light side. What side will you be on? Right now, you're on the dark side. And I wanted to say to these people, hey, it's only a novel. But the weird thing is, it was becoming very clear to me that some people were taking the historical assertions within the Da Vinci Code kind of seriously. And so time went on, the months went on, and I wrote another piece for our Sunday Visitor, kind of a question and answer kind of thing about the Da Vinci Code. And I started saying to our Sunday Visitor, the publisher, I think we should do a book. Because the email just kept coming in, and the sales of the Da Vinci Code kept going up and up and up and up. And I started hearing things like churches using the Da Vinci Code as a springboard for discussion. And I started saying to our Sunday Visitor, we really should do a book. And they said, no, it's only a novel. And then finally, 2 years ago, in February of 2004, they finally got the message. And they said, we want you to do a book. I said, great. And they said, well, and we want it available for the spring trade shows, so you have 2 weeks to write it. Do you think you can do it? And I said, well, you know, let's batten down the hatches and, you know, fill up the freezer and, you know, take out gift certificates to Wendy's and let's go. And so I did it. And, you know, sometimes people say, wow, it only took you 2 weeks to write it. Well, first of all, you know, it's not War and Peace here. But secondly, when you have a modicum of knowledge of church history, you know, it doesn't take extensive research to debunk the Da Vinci Code. It really doesn't. Yeah, I had to do research on the art, because I'm not an art historian. I had to do research on the Priory of Sion and all that kind of esoteric stuff. But other than that, you know, it's not a big challenge, because the stuff is so wrong, okay? And the book sold well, has sold well, and I still get my email. I still get my letters. For about a year, it went into quiescence, but now the past few months it's starting to heat up again as people happen upon my website and my reviews and get irritated at me for not liking the Da Vinci Code. But the interesting thing I want to say, and this is something that's really struck me in the past few weeks, is that there are really three categories of people who take the Da Vinci Code seriously. There are some people who really do sort of buy hook, line, and sinker. Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married. There's a bloodline, you know, from their descendants. In fact, National Geographic, actually a couple of years ago, did a survey of Canadian readers and found that at that point, 17% of all Canadian readers had read the Da Vinci Code, and a third of those readers believed that Jesus and Mary Magdalene had been married and had a bloodline of descendants still living and so on, and Mary was the real Holy Grail and so on. So you have those people. And then you have a second category of people who, you know, may not care that much or may not really know about the Jesus and Mary Magdalene stuff and the bloodline stuff, but what the Da Vinci Code does is confirm their belief that the past is essentially unknowable, and that all this stuff happened so long ago, and that all the sources are basically of the same value, and therefore Jesus could have married Mary Magdalene or could not, and we just don't really know. And the third category of people really like the Da Vinci Code, but for no other reason except that it bashes Christianity. And I'm not normally sort of one to like play the anti-Catholic card, because I don't think that's a really useful category. I mean, what you see is anti-Catholic, I may not, and vice versa. But this really struck me because earlier last week, I got an email, and it struck me that this wasn't the first that I've gotten like this, in which the heading on the email was, "Your review of the Da Vinci Code." And then the email goes on and never mentions the Da Vinci Code. And the email is all, surely, you know, you're just blinded by your religious faith and you don't know what evil the Catholic Church has been responsible for. And you need to just admit this and admit that Christianity has been against knowledge and against truth and all that kind of thing. again, without ever mentioning the Da Vinci Code. And I thought, this is important, okay? Because the fact is, if you go to, like, discussion boards, people tell me to stay away from them because they're bad for my blood pressure, but, like, on the internet, like the IMDb discussion board, the International Movie Database discussion on the Da Vinci Code, people are on there, like, fighting and screaming, but they're not fighting and screaming about the Da Vinci Code. They're fighting and screaming about Christianity. And the odd thing to me, and this is the last introductory thing I'll say before I get into the meat of this, is that those of you who've read the Da Vinci Code know that it's not like atheistic in its sensibility. It's sort of vaguely spiritual in its sensibility. And for atheists to kind of grab onto the Da Vinci Code as some sort of, you know, help to them is just silly, because one of the great ironies of the Da Vinci Code, and this is a good thing to sort of throw at people, if they're talking about how great the Da Vinci Code is that in the Da Vinci Code, everybody but Jesus gets to be divine. You know? Have you noticed that? Is that, you know, it's not the fact that, you know, it's anti-spiritual or the divinity doesn't exist, it's just that Jesus doesn't get to be divine. Mary Magdalene does. Her descendants do, but Jesus doesn't. So that's sort of this fundamental illogical point in the Da Vinci Code. Now, what I'm going to do tonight is I'm going to go through what I think are the foundational issues related to the Da Vinci Code that sort of matter for us and our faith. There are books that very worthily and valiantly pick apart every little mistake in the Da Vinci Code. And since there are three or four on every page, you know, that takes a long time. You know, sometimes people ask me, well, what's correct in the Da Vinci Code? I say, well, Paris exists. The Louvre is in Paris. Leonardo existed. And that's really about it. I mean, you go online. I found a webpage of a guy who has done a detailed analysis of how Dan Brown describes Paris in the Da Vinci Code, and found that it's all wrong. Just as when I was in Rome a couple of months ago, and, you know, on the plane, you know, you had your requisite number of people with Da Vinci Code in hand, but also Angels and Demons, Dan Brown's previous novel, which is set in Rome. And I had the opportunity to talk to a couple of tour guides in Rome who are being driven absolutely mad by Dan Brown fans, because people come with Angels and Demons in hand, and they want to see what's in Angels and Demons. And it doesn't matter if it doesn't match reality or not. You know, they're mad if the tour guide can't point them to what Angels and Demons tells them is true. And so, yeah, lots and lots of details that are kind of fun to pick apart and that just show within, you know, 10 minutes how we shouldn't take the Da Vinci Code or Angels and Demons as a reliable source for history or geography or anything. But what I want to sort of help you understand are the foundational issues here. Because actually, when you think about it, and I hope you'll see this when I'm done, the foundational issues are ones that a lot of us who grapple with faith issues, period, are grappling with. They touch on questions of who is Jesus, what was early Christianity, and so on. Now, for those of you who haven't read the Da Vinci Code, let me do a very, very Da Vinci Code for Dummies. Is that my moron? Summary here, okay? The Da Vinci Code starts off in the Louvre, where there's a murder, okay? And the murder of a curator in the Louvre named Jacques Saunier. And Jacques Saunier is an old guy who is found dead. But before he died, he evidently found time to arrange himself in imitation of the famous Leonardo schematic drawing of the human figure, the Vitruvian Man, and left some other odd things around too. The law is called in, and they in turn call in a fellow named Robert Langdon, played by Tom Hanks in the film, who is an American symbologist, there is no such field, from Harvard, there is a Harvard, who is in Paris for a conference and whose name was in Saunier's datebook. And so they call him in the middle of the night to try to see if there's a connection. They also call in a young woman named Sophie Nouveau. And Sophie is a codebreaker, a cryptologist with French law enforcement, and also, we very quickly discover, Sonia's granddaughter. And so she gets to the scene, and she discerns very quickly that Grandpère has left clues for her, because that's sort of their game from when she was a child, was him teaching her how to decode and figure out, you know, codes and all that kind of thing. But she looks around and she sees stuff, but she also sees that maybe the law should know about this, and she connects with Robert Langdon, and we're off. And we're off through 595 pages, which amazingly cover 24 hours of activity and take us from France to Scotland and back to France. And the gist of the novel is that what Sophie figures out is that Grandpère was communicating a secret about life, maybe even a secret about her. And the secret is this. Grandpère was a grandmaster of an organization called the Priory of Sion. And the Priory of Sion is an ancient organization charged with protecting a secret. And the secret is that Jesus is not the Jesus of the New Testament, not the Jesus of the church. Jesus was a mild-mannered, human, only human, only mortal teacher whose primary teaching was the reunion of the masculine and feminine principles in reality. And he chose Mary Magdalene to be not only his consort, but the leader of his movement. They produced a child. She was pregnant with his child when he was crucified, when he was killed. And that they produced a bloodline of descendants that keep this secret, that are like the embodiment of this secret. Mary Magdalene is the real Holy Grail of history because she literally carries the blood of Jesus in her. And that all of this is related to a retrieval of the sacred feminine within human history. And indeed, we find out, of course, that Sophie herself is a part of this holy bloodline. And the Da Vinci Code ends with Robert Langdon alone back in France in the Ayenpe-designed pyramid that is one of the entrances to the Louvre. And he goes down there because he's figured out that this is the place where Mary, the Holy Grail is, where Mary Magdalene's relics and maybe documents related to her are. And the book ends with him sort of hearing the voices of women through the ages speaking to him. Ta-da. You know, that's it. And Leonardo da Vinci comes into it because he is also past grandmaster of the Priory of Sion and encoded these secrets in his work. So that's it. Now, I feel like an idiot even standing up here reciting this to you because it's so silly, isn't it? But the weird thing is, and I don't, you know, I'm asked why all the time and I have my ideas, partly because of people's lack of information and lack of education, partly because of the way the book is written, because Dan Brown in his book includes the name of other real books, which he cites as, quote, scholarly sources, because he's got a more extensive bibliography on his website, because the way the characters talk to each other about this stuff, you know, T. Bing, who is the other main scholar character, says things, well, you know, Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married. Of course, the historical evidence is very clear on this and things like that. People who don't know better, people who don't have a background in this, people who've never heard anybody ever talk about the origins of Christianity, read this and say, Unfortunately, a lot of people are. You know, a lot of people are reading it saying, well, that's stupid. But some people are indeed reading it as really interesting information that they never knew about early Christianity. Well, there's a reason they never knew about it, right? It's because it's false. And so, you know, what do we make of this? I think when we're talking about the Da Vinci Code to people, to our friends and our relatives, you know, first of all, we have to understand that what we have here is an opportunity. It's not a time, you know, to get all censorious and into boycotting and all that kind of thing, I don't think. It's a time to say, you're interested in Jesus? Good. Let's talk about Jesus. Okay? But if you're stuck with somebody who's really sort of into this and is accusing you of being a close-minded Catholic, who is saying to you things like, you just don't want to admit it, you know, you're just afraid of what the truth is going to do to your faith, whether it's sort of the holy bloodline stuff specifically, or just sort of the general, the early story of Jesus is can't be known, and any story about Jesus is okay as long as it resonates with you. I'm going to give you some pointers, okay? How to really sort of knock the power out of that, knock the energy out of that other side. Because the fact is, I mean, and this is just the cold, hard truth, and it shouldn't even need to be said. Is that not even the most liberal universities in the United States of America are teaching that the Priory of Sion is the protector of the truth about Jesus and Mary Magdalene. Okay, it's just not happening. You know, there's a lot of ambiguity and discussion about early Christianity. That's why departments of religion exist. That's why, you know, scholarly journals, you know, kill trees, you know, for their pages and their arguments, because people do disagree on these things. But that, the Da Vinci Code story is not on the table. Okay? And you need to confront people with this and say, explain to me why. Why do you think this is? And the first reason has to do with the sources. Because the fact is that the Da Vinci Code is not the result of sort of exhaustive original research, right? I mean, any of you who've read it should know this, that Dan Brown essentially used three sources to build the secret of his novel, and then sort of construct his suspense plot around it. Three sources. One, Holy Blood, Holy Grail. And those of you who are following the news know that we've just finished up a trial in England in which two of the authors of Holy Blood, Holy Grail sued Dan Brown for plagiarism. Now, the British laws on this are different. I never could quite sort out what the lawsuit was based on, but Dan Brown won. Although, some of the cynics among us observe that both Holy Blood and Holy Grail and the Da Vinci Code are both published by divisions of Random House. So, you know, we have to ask, who really did win and lose? Did anybody win and lose this case? Holy Blood, Holy Grail, that's where he gets not the marriage of Jesus and Mary Magdalene stuff, but the, obviously, Holy Bloodline stuff. The Templar Revelation, this is where he gets the Leonardo stuff and the Priory of Sion stuff. The Templar Revelation was written by two people who have some other works to their credit. One of them that I'm especially fond of pointing out is the Mammoth Book of UFOs. Okay, so, you know, there's source number two. Source number three is the work of a woman named Margaret Starbird, who is not a scholar, but who is a very popular writer these days on Mary Magdalene. And she has created a very sort of intricate mythology, modern mythology about Mary Magdalene that's reliant actually on numerology, on a numerological reading of the New Testament to support her case that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married and they produced a child named Sarah and so on and so forth. So that's it. Okay, those are the sources for the Da Vinci Code. Notice what's missing. The New Testament. Gospels. Now, some people will say to you, as they have said to me, well, the New Testament's not reliable anyway. They will say, oh, well, it was written so long after the events they purport to describe. It's not reliable. It's a document of faith anyway. It's not intended to be history. And therefore, it tells us one story. Other documents tell us another story. Who knows what's true? Who knows? Well, here's the deal. It's not that much of a crapshoot, okay? The New Testament can be held up to the same, and is held up to the same kind of scholarly evaluation as any other ancient text. It has problems related to it. It has challenges related to it, just like any other ancient text. Okay? But the fact is, think about this. All of the books of the New Testament were composed before the end of the first century. Not that long after the events they describe. Maybe to us in our age of instant communication it seems like a long time, but really, you think about it. We're talking about a movement started by a Jewish preacher in the backwaters of the Roman Empire who formed his movement from uneducated followers, and who was executed as a criminal. It's miraculous that we have anything, all right? Much less the weight of documentation that we have. And the fact is, when you look at the New Testament and look at the other texts that are not in the Bible, texts like the Didache, Shepherd of Hermas, that date from late first, early second century, you actually do find a consistent story, okay? What you find is this. You don't see, for example, one gospel saying that Jesus preached the kingdom of God and another one saying he didn't. You don't see one foundational text of the first century saying that Jesus was crucified and others saying that he wasn't. Even pagan sources that admit the existence of Jesus in the first and second century cite him as being crucified. Okay? So the fact is that we've actually got a lot of information on this early Christian movement. And however, what you make of that, your decision as to what that ultimately says about Jesus, whether he is Lord, is a matter of faith. The Gospels are history reflected through the prism of faith. There is no doubt about that. But what there is also no doubt about is that the apostles who preached that early message weren't preaching something that they didn't believe was true, that they didn't believe happened. One of the craziest things in the Da Vinci Code is Dan Brown's assertion that Christians didn't believe that Jesus was Lord until Constantine made them in 325. And this is sort of the core of his argument as much as it is an argument, is that he says that up until 325, Christian or followers of Jesus sort of followed him as a teacher and followed him for his wise teaching, but didn't worship him as Lord. But Constantine, in his need and quest to maintain power and maintain power as a single ruler, demanded that Christianity sort of change its teaching and acknowledge Jesus as the single Lord that would be reached through a single religion that would be mediated by a single emperor. This is just false. Okay? And even secular historians know this is patently false. And it doesn't take a lot to see this in a very personal way. All it takes is to take your Bible and to open it to the letters of Paul. Paul existed. No one disputes that. Paul's letters were written by Paul, dictated perhaps, but they come from the mind of Paul. All written, 30, 40, 50 years after Jesus' death and resurrection. And any scholar will tell you that the letters of Paul have what we call a very high Christology. And to get a sense of what that means, all you have to do is open your Bible to Philippians chapter 2, which is our reading on Palm Sunday and on Good Friday as well. A hymn, which some people say Paul might have composed himself. Some say he might have adapted from a hymn that was already being sung in Christian communities. Though he was in the form of God, he did not deem equality with God something to be grasped at. He being Jesus, of course. Rather, he emptied himself and took the form of a slave, so that at his name, every knee in heaven and on earth and below the earth shall bend and declare and proclaim that Jesus Christ is Lord. That is not just honoring a guy who's teaching you, like. Okay, that is worshiping Jesus. No, they couldn't articulate the philosophical manifestations of that and what that meant about Jesus' dual nature and how he related to God the Father and the Holy Spirit. No, and that's what these councils later on were doing. We're hashing through, trying to figure that out. But if you read the New Testament with an open mind, what you see coursing through it is this reflection of this experience, this mysterious experience of this man whom they could just say Jesus is Lord. And that is the core of early Christian teaching as reported in the Acts of the Apostles. So, this business about Jesus being viewed as just a human being and not worshipped as Lord until Constantine made them is just wrong. But I think we need to honestly reflect on how insidious even sometimes thinking related to that has been, even if we don't read the Da Vinci Code. You know, I do talk radio, secular talk radio, and I always know I'm in for trouble when a caller starts off his question or comment by saying, I'm a Catholic. Because I know what's going to follow is a but. I'm a Catholic, but, and they say I was an altar boy, we're in real trouble. It's like the badge of something. I'm a Catholic, but you know, don't you, that the Gospels were written so far after Jesus lived that they don't provide a reliable account. And so, you know, really, whatever story we want to say about Jesus is whatever means something to us, and it's all okay, and we never can know the truth anyway. That's not Christianity. Okay, that's not the Christian message. The second thing that we need to address really hard, besides the sources and lack of them in the Da Vinci Code, is the just sheer illogic of the piece, okay? It just doesn't make any sense. Think about it. One of the things that Dan Brown says, and this might be kind of hard to follow because it's kind of complicated, is that early Christianity was a battle. It was a political battle between the Peter Party and the Mary Magdalene Party, okay? And obviously the Mary Magdalene Party are the good people, right? Because they're the ones that understand the true nature of the Christian message. And the Peter Party are obviously led by Peter. And these are the people that ultimately ended up with all the power. And they're the ones that selected the Gospels out of the 80 that were out there. Lie, okay? But these are the ones that won the battle. History is written by the winners. Okay, this is one of the sort of the memes, one of the constant themes in the Da Vinci Code, both the novel and the film. And so what eventually happened was that the Peter Party won because it was so into getting power, and the Mary Magdalene Party lost and was repressed, and Mary Magdalene was demonized as a whore because the Peter Party was determined to cover up the, you know, that fundamental, foundational power of the sacred feminine. Now, does that make any sense? Because think about this. First of all, I mean, you know, just forget the evidence, okay? I mean, the evidence obviously shows this isn't true, but logic is always kind of fun to play with from people because they're not going to take your evidence. They're not going to take the New Testament as a reliable historical source. Then you need to go to logic. And you might ask this, okay, the Peter Party wanted power. Why? What did it get them? Okay. Were Christians in the second century ascending to great positions of power in the Roman Empire? I missed that. Okay? Because the history I read says that the early Christians were like persecuted, arrested, martyred. So either this Peter Party was really stupid or just crazy. Okay? And this whole Mary Magdalene stuff, you know. And the other thing that you might want to suggest is, you know, if the Peter Party was so intent on suppressing the real function and role and importance of Mary Magdalene, they did a really bad job. Because, first of all, if they are the ones responsible for selecting the Gospels that we now have in the New Testament, who discovers the empty tomb? In all four Gospels, Mary Magdalene, who is the first witness to this? Who is the first one to encounter the risen Christ? Who is the one who was called in Eastern Christianity, apostle to the apostles? Mary Magdalene. So this Peter party did a really bad job. They failed. Secondly, moving a little bit further in history, Mary Magdalene was demonized throughout Christian history. You could have fooled me. Because what do we call her? Saint? Mary Magdalene, that's an odd way of demonizing people. But I guess people who like try to seek power by getting martyred would do something like that. And so, you know, she's a saint. Her feast day is July 22nd. She was, by any way that we can try to count or measure these things, she was the second most popular saint of the Middle Ages after the Blessed Virgin. She was incredibly popular because what she represented was the hope for repentance. And I want to just get a little bit more specific on this here. One of the things that you will hear a lot about Mary Magdalene over the next few weeks, if you, you know, watch TV and hear people opining and pontificating on this, is that Pope Gregory I in 591 made the association of Mary Magdalene with a prostitute. And from that point on in the Catholic Church, she was condemned and maligned and diminished as a prostitute, when in fact, of course, she was the apostle to the apostles. And this shows, of course, that the Catholic Church has been fundamentally opposed to the role of women. The fact is, if you go and read Gregory's homily, this is what you'll find. And it is available online. This is not any big secret Gnostic thing here. In 591, Gregory the Great preached a homily, okay? And in it, he noted some things. And I want to say first that he wasn't the first one. For 500 years, various thinkers, theologians, scripture scholars had been sort of wondering about Mary Magdalene, who was she, and wondering about all these other women that are in the Gospels. Some of them have names, some of them don't have names, and so a lot of them are named Mary, okay? And some scholars had wondered, well, couldn't these be like the same people? And in 591, Gregory the Great preached a homily in which he suggested that Mary Magdalene, who is introduced in Luke chapter 8, as a woman from whom Jesus had driven out seven demons, and who then gave up everything she had to follow Jesus along with some other women and provide for the disciples of Jesus to provide for their needs, that this woman introduced by name as Mary Magdalene in Luke chapter 8 might be the same woman in a story in Luke chapter 7 that directly precedes this, in which an unnamed woman, identified as a sinner, comes to Jesus in a Pharisee's home, repents of her sin, and, you know, anoints him and washes and dries his feet with her hair. And maybe even this woman might even be the same as Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus. Okay? Now, who knows if he's right or not? I talked to a friend of mine who said, you know, maybe the Holy Spirit was with him. You know, maybe he did make a connection that should have been made. Who knows? But from that point on, in the West, the connection was made between Mary Magdalene, as she's named, the woman of Luke chapter 7, repentant woman, and Mary, the sister of Martha and Lazarus. And later, legends sometimes associated her with even the woman Jesus caught in adultery and John and so forth. And what Gregory did when he preached his homily, he didn't say, look at Mary Magdalene and scorn her. He said, look at Mary Magdalene and what Jesus did for her. And look what Jesus can do for us. It was about repentance and forgiveness and hope. And look what a faithful disciple she was. And from that point on, in the Western Church, the connections were made up until the calendar was revised after the Second Vatican Council. And the image of Mary Magdalene was of a repentant sinner for the most part. Okay? Although I will say that in art, she's probably, in the Middle Ages, more heavily represented by her presence at the cross. You know, whenever you see a medieval or Renaissance depiction of the crucifixion, you can see usually three recognizable figures there. You can see Mary, the mother of Jesus, you can see John, and you can see Mary Magdalene. She's usually dressed in red, and she has a jar somewhere around her. Okay, she might be carrying it. It might be on the ground because she is, you know, associated with a woman who not only anointed Jesus as the repentant woman, but also because, of course, she came to anoint Jesus' body. But again, she wasn't held up as a criminal. She wasn't laughed at. The focus was not on any perceived sin. The focus was on what a figure of hope. In fact, some artists would sometimes do two paintings, one of Mary Magdalene and one of Peter. Both disciples of Jesus who found great forgiveness. Okay? And so there's a lot more that could be said about Mary Magdalene. I haven't even touched on the purported marriage of Jesus and Mary Magdalene. I'll just say very quickly, again, no historical evidence for it. Not even anything in legendary material. Okay, the Gnostic writings are a completely different story. The modern interpreters who sometimes posit a marriage relationship between Jesus and Mary Magdalene, which incidentally is not serious scholars, okay? You know, probably the most foremost Mary Magdalene scholar in the country that you will probably see a lot of on television is a woman named Karen King from Harvard. And even she says, no, you know, Jesus and Mary Magdalene were not married. She posits a kind of a greater role for Mary Magdalene in early Christianity than others, but she says, you know, there's nothing to this marriage business. That's purely a creation of 20th century speculation. The only marriage of Mary Magdalene that we ever see sort of referred to is in some of the legendary material. Believe me, there is a ton of fascinating legendary material about Mary Magdalene in both West and East, and they're slightly different. But the only one that's related to a marriage, and again, this is legend that, you know, crops up 1,200 years after the events, so take it, you know, as that, is that there was, in some legend collections, she was described as the bride at the wedding in Cana. And John was the groom. And when Jesus came and turned water into wine, that so sort of, you know, blew John out of the water that he became an apostle, which made Mary Magdalene so mad that she then went off and led her dissolute life, okay, from which she eventually repented and all that kind of thing. And that made for great drama and medieval mystery plays and all of that kind of thing. But, you know, there's really nothing else. And there is a lot of really interesting legendary material related to Mary Magdalene, but it's all rooted in Mary's discipleship. It's all rooted in a very sort of authentic sense of Mary as disciple, as apostle to the apostles. Now, why does it matter? I'm going to take about 5 minutes to wrap this up, and then we'll have some questions. I've been doing a lot of thinking about this, because quite frankly, sometimes when I stand up to talk about the Da Vinci Code one more time, I just sort of want to run screaming from the room. Or else I want to say, can we talk about, you know, Flannery O'Connor or Walker Percy or Graham Greene instead? But, you know, again, but then every time I give a talk, people come up to me afterwards and say, you know, thank you, you answered my questions and so on. But I want to try to touch on the big picture. You know, why does this matter? Does it matter just because people are allowing themselves to be miseducated by this? No. That's a main reason, but it's not the only reason. I suggest that one of the important reasons why the Da Vinci Code matters is because it is functioning in our culture as an extreme, massive, annoying distraction. It's distracting us, first of all, from good literature. A lot of people say to me, I really like the Da Vinci Code because it grapples with matters of faith in a novel form, and I really like that. It takes religious faith seriously. No, it doesn't. Okay? If you want fiction that grapples seriously with matters of faith, there is no lack of that out there. Some of it you've read here, I know in your discussion groups here in religious ed here, but, you know, just, you know, to run through a few names that I already did, Flannery O'Connor, Graham Greene, Walker Percy, Dostoevsky, Frederick Buchner, another modern writer. You know, we could go on and on and on. These are people who take faith seriously. It's not about games. It's not about codes. It's not about little esoteric faith theories. It's about, why am I here? What does my life mean? Is there a God? What does that mean? Can I ever be forgiven? Is there hope? And what happens to me after I die? And what are the consequences for how I treat other people right here and right now? And there are writers who seriously grapple with that stuff. And to delude ourselves into thinking that the Da Vinci Code is good, you know, faith reading is just nonsense. It's a game. Okay, it may be an entertaining game, but it's just a game. And I'd say the same thing when the movie comes out. You know, the film is not going to be any different from the novel in any substantive way. And if you want to really grapple with faith in a cinematic way, you know, watch The Mission. Watch Robert Duvall's The Apostle. You know, watch Babette's Feast. Watch any number of other great films that are out there that, again, take this stuff seriously. It also, in my mind, functions, even though I'm not an art historian, as a real kind of distraction from the way people should be looking at art. I spoke at the University of Miami in Florida a couple years ago, and at the end of my talk, an art historian got up, and she was holding a copy of the Da Vinci Code, and she said, "You don't know how many people come up to me and say, oh, I learned so much about art from the Da Vinci Code, and I want to say you learned nothing about art from the Da Vinci Code." Because what it has done, it has codified this extremely crude way of looking at art. You know, people sort of searching for clues instead of trying to understand context, instead of trying to really let the art just affect them for what it is. And it is this, you know, it's the same thing with all three things that I've named. It's this diminished, kind of tacky, kind of superficial way of looking at faith and deluding ourselves and thinking that we're being all serious and intellectual about it when in fact we're just being played. Okay. And finally, I think it matters because the Da Vinci Code functions, if we allow it to, as a distraction from Jesus. Somebody wrote me about a year and a half ago saying that her young adult son had read the Da Vinci Code. And she was really glad, because in the Da Vinci Code, her son had discovered a really human Jesus that he could relate to. And that this was different from the Jesus that he knew about from the church and the Gospels. And I wanted to write her back and say, has he ever read a Gospel? Because the fact is, the Jesus of the Da Vinci Code, which is essentially sort of the Jesus of the Gnostic writings, is extremely... And again, if you ever have a chance and you want to just read the Gospel of Philip, Gospel of Thomas, Gospel of Mary, Peace to Sophia, any of these other works that are cited in the Da Vinci Code, be my guest. Do it before you go to sleep, and you'll have a good night's sleep. Okay? Because the Jesus of the Gnostic writings kind of talks and talks and talks and has these dialogues with people, and they're talking about all this esoteric, obscure stuff and about the afterlife and all of this kind of thing. And Jesus never suffers in the Gnostic writings, doesn't die, because in the Gnostic schema, the body is evil, so nothing good can come out of suffering. But if you open a gospel, and this is, you know, you need to dare people to read a gospel with an open mind from chapter 1 to chapter 15 or chapter 28, however long it is. And what do they find? What do we find when we read the Gospels? We find a human being who was born of a woman, miraculously, but born of a woman, who worried his parents, who, according to Luke, grew in wisdom in some mysterious sense, who had friends, who worried his friends and neighbors, and in fact, kind of alienated them. They drove him out of town, threatened his life, who puzzled his family, who had friends who scandalized people, who ended up calling him a glutton and a drunkard, who ate, shared meals, who was afraid, who was arrested, who was tortured, suffered, and died. Don't tell me that's not human. If you think about the most frequently used images of Jesus in Christian iconography, there are two. One is a baby sitting on his mother's lap, sometimes nursing. And the second is a man suffering, dying, and sometimes even returned to his mother's lap. Don't tell me that's not human. I thought an awful lot about why some people seem to prefer the Jesus of the Da Vinci Code. And something came to me a few weeks ago. The Jesus of the Da Vinci Code sort of goes around telling people they're okay and to find their inner core and their inner being and unite the feminine and the masculine. What does the Jesus of the Gospel say? He says, love your enemy. He says, sell everything you have and give the money to the poor. He says, take up your cross. He says, if you want to serve me, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, visit the imprisoned. He says, don't worry about what happens tomorrow. Let God provide for your needs. He says, turn the other cheek. And he says, again, love your enemy. No wonder we prefer the Jesus of the Da Vinci Code. No wonder. He's a lot easier on us. But the fact is, the Jesus of the Da Vinci Code is cold on a page. He never saved anybody. And it's our opportunity right now to introduce people to the Jesus who can save, the Jesus of the Gospels, the Jesus that we meet here every day if we choose in Eucharist, in the sacraments, in the church, in his body. Because that Jesus saves. Our world is a world of hurt and a world of pain. It's not the Jesus of the Da Vinci Code that anyone needs. It's the real Jesus. Thank you. Yeah. Now, I don't know if we want to do any questions. Maybe I can take a couple really quick. I do have to do my awful commercial and say I have books for sale, which are great confirmation and First Communion gifts and all that kind of thing. Maybe I'll take two or three questions. Yes, sir. Mary Magdalene is not identified as a prostitute in the gospel. She's identified as a woman from whom Jesus drove out demons. And then, you know, Gregory, as I said, made that association between her and the repentant sinner in Luke 7, who also is not identified as a prostitute. But, you know, in past ages, you know, when they sometimes thought about what would, you know, a sinful woman be, it was usually sort of connected to a sexual sin. But as I said, you know, in medieval legend and devotion to Mary, that wasn't what was emphasized. Secondly, Dan Brown says that he was a Christian. He's a Christian. He says that. He said that in his trial in London. Not only that he was raised a Christian, but that he is a Christian. If you look it up, there's some kind of statement he made that, you know, he sort of differentiates himself from Holy Blood, Holy Grail, because he says he would never deny the resurrection. I mean, it's not like he mentions it in the Da Vinci Code, but, you know, he says he would never deny the resurrection. And non-Catholic Christians have, you know, gone to town and can be on finding the Da Vinci Code too. I mean, there have been a number of books published by Protestant, you know, evangelical houses. A number of particularly good biblical scholars, Ben Witherington and Daryl Bach, are Protestant biblical scholars who've written books about the Da Vinci Code. And but what's interesting to me is that I think it's an interesting moment. Because it's sort of asking maybe people who haven't ordinarily thought about this stuff to think about things like the establishment of the canon of scripture, the role of church councils in that, and to think about issues about Mary and saints and all that kind of thing. But what's interesting in the Da Vinci Code is, of course, the Catholics are the bad guys, right? And I say in my book, it's sort of a backhanded compliment in a way, because it sort of takes the Catholic Church as the definer of what it means to be Christian. And I really do think that, when you look at pop culture, this is not the first kind of book of its genre. I mean, some of you may remember the movie Stigmata that came out a few years ago, in which there was a hidden gospel, and that if it was revealed, that it would bring down the Catholic Church as we know it. Ever since the discovery of the Nag Hammadi scrolls and the Dead Sea Scrolls back in the 40s, this kind of stuff has floated around in novels and so on, especially because the contents of the Dead Sea Scrolls were kind of kept quiet for a while and then caused a lot of speculation. Access to them was very limited. There were novels written about it, especially in the 60s and early 70s. So it's not the first time. But what's interesting, for those of us who are into film and imagery is, why is it always the Catholics? Why isn't it like the Methodists? But I think it has to do with two things. I think in the popular mind, it's interesting that even in the subconscious, when people think about sort of the organization that defines Christianity, Catholicism sort of ends up being it, but also it's because we have better visuals, right? You can have people running around in cassocks, the high church of Anglicans and Orthodox have that too. I mean, the Orthodox have like better hats than we do. There's more of us, and I think that it's really interesting that, as you point out, he insists on saying the Catholic Church is responsible for all this, when, other Christians believe the New Testament is normative, too. It's not just us. So. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, I'm sorry, I left that part out of my synopsis, didn't I? Yeah, the big bad Catholic Church in the Da Vinci Code is represented by Opus Dei. And Opus Dei, in particular, is represented by a bishop and an albino murderous monk named Silas. And of course, Opus Dei does not have monks. It's a predominantly lay organization. It's not a religious order. They don't murder people. But it's interesting to me that he did pick out Opus Dei. He used it by name. He has maligned them. I think, again, if you know your sort of anti-Catholic culture, I think that, Opus Dei in the Da Vinci Code plays the same role that the Jesuits used to play in old anti-Catholic polemics, and even not so old Catholic polemics. I mean, if you've ever seen a Jack Chick comic book, you know what I'm talking about. It's the Jesuits who are, the maniacal madman, sort of planning assassinations and revolutions and all of that kind of thing, and really in control. And so Opus Dei, because of it has a sense of secrecy about it. I think right before the Da Vinci Code came out, Robert Hansen, who was a member of Opus Dei, was arrested as a double spy on espionage. He worked with the CIA, and he was arrested for passing secrets, I guess, to the Soviets, and he was a member of Opus Dei. And so all of that kind of fed into the moment of, I guess, this would be a good group to, put in my book and make the bad guys. Opus Dei has been kind of frustrated about it because I know they've written to Sony several times, very politely saying, could you please tell us if we're named in your movie as the real bad guys? And Sony won't even answer them. No comment. So, there's no real sense of whether that continues in the film. But I have been to 34th and Lex, to the Opus Dei headquarters, and I didn't see Silas. Of course, he's dead, so I know. I think that's what I'm saying. Any other questions? Yes, sir.
The Priory of Sion enters quite a bit in this book. I have seen on TV and so on that it only goes back a few years, decades, yes. Centuries.
Yes, that is a fact. And thank you for that. It's another thing I left out. If you look at the first page of Dan Brown's book of the Da Vinci Code, he's got a page that's called Fact. And on it, it says the Opus Dei is a real organization. All the documents and texts described in this book are real. And it says the Priory of Sion was a real organization. You know, the lists of grand masters of the Priory of Sion have been found that include Leonardo da Vinci and Victor Hugo and people like that. The Priory of Sion, very short, very briefly, was founded in 1956 by a guy named Pierre Plantard, who was a right-wing anti-Semite French monarchist. He founded the Priory of Sion, which we think maybe at tops had maybe 12 members, as with two things in mind. One, to do something and discuss problems in housing. And secondly, to sort of establish his claims to the French throne. That's sort of a constant theme in French sort of conspiracy theory stuff, as people trying to establish their claim to the French throne. And he got another guy to forge documents, these lists of the Grand Masters, and they actually planted them in French libraries and archives. And all of this was exposed as a fraud in French, on French television, and in books in France, and even in a trial in France in the late 70s and early 80s. So yeah, the Priory of Sion doesn't exist. And to me, that should be, like, be the end of the discussion. I don't know why we would have to, like, talk about it anymore, but apparently, you know, to some people, they're not dissuaded. You can tell them the Priory of Sion doesn't exist, and they'll say, did you know that that's really Mary Magdalene next to Jesus in the Last Supper? You know, that Leonardo put that there because he was planning, but there's no Priory of Sion. Did you know that, you know, it just, you know, sometimes reason just blows over the head of some people. So, any other questions? Yes. Yeah, what she said, and this is a very good point, is that actually Hollywood has played a part in perpetuating the Mary Magdalene as prostitute thing, because even if you, say, look at Zeffirelli's Jesus of Nazareth, I think Anne Bancroft played Mary Magdalene and played her as a repentant prostitute. Yeah, I mean, that was the common way of thinking about her, even perpetuated in Hollywood. Yeah, there's a question in the back. Yes, sir. I know, and that's something that's very important that's going on. I sort of walk a line on this, okay? I am very, very reluctant to tell people that it would be good for them to give money to Sony and Imagine and buy a ticket to go see the Da Vinci Code all for the sake of dialogue. Okay, I really don't want to do that. I don't tell people that they need to read the Da Vinci Code to dialogue about this. Because the fact is that you can dialogue about what's in the Da Vinci Code without, like, seeing it or reading it. You know, the assertions are sort of basic. There's like 10 of them at most. And I've talked about a lot of them here. And their power, such as it is, doesn't rest on literary devices. Is it going to rest on cinematic brilliance? It's, you know, people standing around talking to each other and telling each other, did you know that there were more than 80 Gospels? No, I didn't. Did you, you know, and all that kind of thing. So yeah, the Da Vinci Code, I think, is a great opportunity for evangelization because it has exposed this rather sort of sad vacuum in knowledge, not just of church history, but as I said before, who is Jesus? And so I think it's an opportunity, but I would be, you know, personally wary of saying, you know, let's go see the movie and let's talk about it. You know, I just because that's exactly what the filmmakers want. You know, they like double their ticket sales immediately.
I'm talking about meeting someone who might have gone to school
and
read the book.
Oh, it's our obligation. I mean, it's our, and we can't say, oh, just don't worry about it. It's all enough. I mean, we can't do that because it's an opportunity. You know, almost, you know, God can use anything. And, you know, as I said, if you make the mistake of going online and reading discussion boards about the Da Vinci Code, you will see the most depressing ignorance about who Jesus is. I mean, people are almost hostile to the notion of Jesus. They just have no, you know, and in some sense, it's got to be an indictment of us in a way, you know, and so, you know, it is a real opportunity, and it, you shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't shy from it. We shouldn't, you know, say, don't even talk to me about that stuff. Say, yeah, okay, I want to talk to you about real Jesus, but I'm going to talk to you if you, like, not on, you know, go see the Da Vinci Code, that's your business, that's fine, but let's read the Gospel of Mark together. Let's, you know, read Da Vinci together. Let's, no, let's, you know, reading the Gospel is more important. You know, let's do this, and let me introduce you to the Jesus I know, you know, and it could be a great opportunity. Yes?
What does the Vatican say about the book?
Well, I mean, the Vatican is like this big thing in which, you know, cardinals and other people are always saying things that may or may not speak for the Vatican as a whole. I mean, there have been some cardinals, which is sort of the closest you can get to saying the Vatican, who have commented on the errors within the Da Vinci Code. The closest we can get is that the on Good Friday, not Good Friday, Holy Thursday, or was it Good Friday? Yeah, Good Friday, the pontifical, the preacher for the pontifical household, who is not the Pope, it's a priest, preached in the homily for the Passion, the Liturgy of the Passion of the Lord, preached a homily in which he sort of scored those who would be using, you know, erroneous and exploitive stories about Jesus for their own gain. You know, so, you know, that's as close as we've had. We've had a couple of cardinals, I think Cardinal Bertone and some others who have said, you know, this is silly and, you know, we shouldn't read it and, you know, it's not serious and all that kind of thing. I think, you know, I think they've been sort of startled by the way it's taken off in Europe, because it has. I mean, it's very popular in Europe. It was available in paperback in Europe long before it was available here in paperback. So, any other questions? I thank you very, very much for your attention, and I know there's more refreshments over there, and I will sign books and chat with you for as long as